Good morning, Boker Tov. Nice to see everybody. And as you know probably from last time, I was in London for really since the last year. I went on Wednesday evening last week. It was a bit cooler in London for Shavuos than it was here. That's what I've been told. But it was very nice in London as well, thank God. As I mentioned to you last week, I think the air conditioning is on here. It's just working as hard as it can to do what it can. As I mentioned to you last week, there are a number of shiurim that I'd like to give, starting from today, on the issue of gender, which I think is an extremely important one in today's society. Before I start, I'm pleased to say that today's shiur is kindly sponsored, by Marsha Tukozina and Shelley Budo in memory of their big sister Temi, Devorah Tema, Bat Chaim Mordechai Nechem Aleha Shalom, and her yahrzeit is today, so we're very grateful for their sponsorship, thank you very much, and there should be an aliyah to the neshama, please God, and we should learn this very important issue, and we should learn it well, because this Talmud Torah I think is very critical. It's not an easy issue to deal with, and some people might feel a little uncomfortable dealing with it, and I certainly don't wish to make anyone feel uncomfortable, but I don't think it's something that we should avoid, because it is around us very much in society. The truth is that this issue should really be a whole symposium of different shiurim and talks. There should be psychotherapists and people talking about the political angles and rabbis and about Hashkafa and Halacha. This today that I'm going to present to you is just one shiur, and I've decided not to do multiple shiurim on this. We'll try and do what we can in one shiur and go on to other issues next week. But there are a large number of questions to raise, and I've given you on page one a list of questions which I think need to be addressed, and I will not be able to address them all today. Is there a Jewish view on gender and the key differences between male and female? That's a whole book, and I've recommended books on that in the footnotes in other places. Is there a Jewish perspective on a person who feels that their real spiritual gender is different to their anatomical sexuality? And do we have a perspective on whether that is a quote-unquote genuine feeling or a spiritual reality in some way? We'll have a little bit on that. On a much more technical halakhic issue, is it permissible for a person to have a gender reassignment surgery, which a significant number of people have had? It's not known exactly how many operations of this nature are carried out per year, but it's estimated in the thousands. And therefore, since these things have been happening for many years now, there are tens of thousands, if not more, people in the world who've had gender reassignment surgery. This is certainly coming onto my radar screen more as someone who receives questions. I think I mentioned to you, I had a question a week or two ago from a student who I taught a number of years ago, who's now dorming in Washington Heights, in her late 20s, and she's just discovered that the girl she's going to be, a woman she's going to be dorming with, used to be a man, and has had a gender reassignment surgery, and she wants to know what are the implications for that, for yichud, for negia, etc., etc. And again, these are not theoretical questions. She's not the only person in that situation. It won't be long before we have people who've had this kind of surgery applying for Torah institutions, this is not new. In Stern College, very famously, there's a teacher who's had a gender reassignment surgery. That was already years ago. There'll be people applying to yeshivas and seminaries. And people will have to have an approach to this. I'm certainly not here to put any kind of agenda or policy for that. But what is the halachic issue in having a gender reassignment surgery? Perhaps most interesting for us today, from a Jewish perspective, because that's our perspective that we're focusing on, if a person does have a gender reassignment surgery, does that change the gender? Yes or no? And that's going to have a lot of very interesting implications. We talked a little bit about yichud, etc. And then there are two much bigger questions, which I don't really have time to deal with today. We'll just touch on them, which are what should be our individual and communal response to individuals who've been through this scenario or who are in the process of going through this? How should we as Jewish halachically and hashkafically sensitive individuals treat such people, and how should the society as a whole treat such people? How do those people fit into shuls? Many people, even if they have been through this kind of situation, they want to continue to be part of an Orthodox community. Just because a person who has had a gender reassignment surgery doesn't mean necessarily that they wish to disassociate themselves from halachic life. And there have been cases in different communities where, in Canada, there was a case many years ago already where a young man who grew up in the community transitioned to a woman, wanted to be on the Ezras Nashim, and the community had very mixed feelings about that, understandably. And again, I can't here set a sort of an approach which is in any way universal on that, but that's a question. And then finally, there's a question which I don't have time to deal with today very much at all, which is, how do we as a community deal with the whole political gender issue, which goes past transgender into issues of homosexuality and the general approach that presents itself in the secular world on this issue, and how should we respond to that, the whole cultural shift which we've seen over the last 30, 40 years? That's obviously a massive question. And I'm raising these questions because I think we at least need to know the questions, even if we can't get through all the answers, but we will touch on some of these issues. Before I start, I would recommend two excellent shiurim on this you can get online. One of them is by Rav Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, who gave a shiur, which is a video available online. I didn't put a link to it, but you can find it very easily. Just Google Rabbi Weinreb and transgender, and he gave a shiur about 2 years ago, about for an hour and a half. You should really watch that. Very interesting. And also Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, who is, I think, quite a well-known, very important rabbinical figure in America, in Boca Raton. He gave a shiur on this some time ago as well. I put a reference to his shiur here, and he has an excellent source sheet on the issue. So there are people talking about this. I'm certainly not the first, and I recommend their shiurim. Let's go through the sheet, the first bit of the sheet quite quickly, and then we'll come on to the questions that I'm really interested in going into in more depth. I've given you a little extract from Wikipedia on what is transgender. I'm not going to read through that now. I'm sure people are aware, basically, of what that is, that there are certain individuals who feel, for any number of reasons, that may be physical, psychological, in different ways, that the anatomical sex that they are born as, either male or female, which is normally a binary thing, although we'll see not necessarily entirely, that they feel that their gender identification is different from that, and some people just merely wish to identify in a different way. Other people actually wish to have some kind of physical surgery to change that anatomical reality. And again, this is not a new thing at all. We'll see soon. The Ibn Ezra talks about transgender already 1,000 years ago, but this is certainly something which is much more common. There is a psychological syndrome, let's call it, called gender dysphoria, which is classified as a psychological issue, as an illness on some level, by the WHO, by the World Health Organization. Not to say that they understand that transgender itself is, or gender identification is, an illness psychologically, but there are many, many psychological, if you like, accompanying psychological issues that come together with transgender. And this becomes a political issue, of course, in the outside world, as to what extent do you wish to classify something as an illness or a disorder. And I'm not getting into that. There are people with very strident views, obviously, one way or the other on that. But still, it is important to understand that transgender issues bring with them a lot of psychological problems. Again, it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, which is the cause of which, and again, I'm not qualified to get into that. There are extremely high rates of suicide of people who feel this gender dysphoria. And by the way, I would go on to say that even after they have the surgery of gender reassignment, there are also extremely high rates of suicide. This does not solve the problem. Which is important, because sometimes it's presented in a rather simplistic way. All they need to do is do X and it solves the problem. That's not true. And I brought you over the page on page 2. Again, you can read this for yourself, a couple of extracts on the psychological issues, and you can do your own research and look into this. But it is a real problem, and on an individual level, a real tragedy, when people feel that they need to grapple with these issues and what they need to do about it. And that will feed into a little bit into the halachic scenarios as well. As for how many people are transgender, or feel the need to be transgender, so that is also a political issue. Different people wish to upplay or downplay the figures. I brought you something, again, I'm not telling you that it's true because it's on Wikipedia, but you can do your own research, that they want to say that there are as many as 0.5% of Americans, which you're talking about 1.5 million adults, who they feel are somehow or other in a transgender scenario or wish to be or could be, etc. Again, I have no way of knowing whether that figure is accurate, wildly overestimated, wildly underestimated, but it's certainly not something that is extremely fringe and minority, and it's certainly not something which is going away. So with that introduction, let's get into some of the halachic issues. The first couple of questions, which is, what are the perspectives of gender? Well, that's something we have a lot to talk about, because the very opening of Bereishis is the creation of a male and a female. Look in number 4, Vayivra Elokim et Adam, God creates humankind, v'tzamo, in God's image. That's not obviously a physical image, that's taken to be a spiritual or intellectual, depending on which approach you take. But Tzelem Elokim bara oto, mankind was created in the Tzelem Elokim, Zachar u'nekeva bara otam. Zachar and Nekeva, there seems to be some kind of binary creation. There's a Zachar, there's a male, there's a Nekeva, there is a female. On the other hand, that is confused slightly when we get to the next chapter of Bereishis, and which is very well known, which is that there seems just to be Adam, the male, and Chava is separated off from Adam. And Chazal quite famously try to harmonize these two sources and work out, well, how can it be Zachar and Nekeva, they were created, and then it seems the female was taken from the male. And the Midrash in number 6, which, as I say, I think is quite well known, Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah ben Elazar, B'sha Shebara Kodesh Baruch Hu et Adam Arishon, when God created Adam Arishon, Androgynous Bara'o. So the first view in the Midrash is that mankind was originally created as an androgynous being, without any clear binary Zachar and Nekeva. Okay, and somehow that androgynous being was separated out into male and female. Again, these are midrashim. They're not meant to be taken on a simplistic level. They're certainly not halachic. But even to understand what it's talking about takes a lot of digging. Even the psukim in Bereishis are not, you can't just read a pshat in the pasuk in Bereishis. Like Rabbi Akiva Tatz once said to me, that when you read a pasuk in, let's say, Dvarim, so you're reading a pshat, and if you want to dig to the sod, to the deeper mystical level, so you have to dig, 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 dig. When you're reading the account of creation in Bereishis, you're reading a mystical level on the surface. You're not reading a pshat. You're certainly not reading, quote unquote, what happened in some simple way. You have to really work out how to read them in a more sophisticated way. Ma'aseh Bereishis is classified by Chazal as one of the deepest secrets of our understanding of reality. So whatever this means, androgynous, there was some lack of binary nature to the sexuality, to the gender initially. That's why it says the male and female in the one creature. Then Rav Shmuel Bar Nachman disagrees and says, no, B'sha Shebara Kodesh Baruch Hu Adam Arishon, Diyu Part Sufim Bara'o. It wasn't an androgynous being. It was a male and female, but with a kind of two faces, male facing one way, female facing the other way. And again, I don't think we should just have a simple physical image in our mind. This obviously represents something. For Nasra, and then he separates them, the Asu Gabayim, Gavkan, the Gavlakan, etc., etc. There's a whole discussion, is if man was facing one way and woman was facing the other way in this two-faced being, who was leading? Was it the man walking forwards with the woman following, or the woman walking forwards with the man following? And some of you already think you know the answer to that, that's fine, but that's an interesting separate discussion. And of course, just anatomically, the male and female anatomy is in many ways parallel, and the Kuzari picks up on this, and Chazal focus on that as well, that the female anatomy is much more internal, the male anatomy is more external, but they're very much parallel and analogous to each other. So already in terms of the creation of the human being, it's not simple. It's not just a question of a man and a woman. There's something more complex, at least on a spiritual level, of male and female. And I brought that out in number 9, where I brought you a piece from Rav Soloveitchik, which I, courtesy of Rabbi Goldberg's source sheet, which, as I said, is extremely helpful. So Rabbi Soloveitchik here has a very interesting piece on gender. I just want to read you a couple of lines. He says here, in the image of God he created in male and female, what is the meaning of the juxtaposition of the reference to the image of God with the creation of man's two sexes? In interpreting the phrase male and female he created them, Chazal explained that when God initially created Adam, he created him in dual form. Male and female in this context has been taken not only in a physiological sense, but also in a spiritual stroke metaphysical one. Like I said, it's much deeper than you would think. Every soul, says Robert Soloveitchik, consists of spiritual androgyny. That's what he means, androgynous. A male and a female persona. Just skip a couple of lines. Man both influences and is influenced. He's both giver and receiver. Only in the biological world is man exclusively male or female. In the spiritual world, every individual carries both traits. They're called Dukhra and Nukva. Dukhra is the male, Nukva is the female. And only through the development of both the Dukhra and the Nukva perspectives can individuals attain their full spiritual potential. And if you go down to the next where I've underlined here, the blessing that God bestowed on man during creation operates in both spiritual metaphysical realm as well as the physical realm. Actualizing the potential of Dukhra, the Nukva, is the greatest and most exalted of blessings. Basically, Rav Soloveitchik is therefore saying that every human being has a spiritual male and a spiritual female within their neshama and needs to develop both sides. I brought you a reference in the bottom to a very interesting book on this by Miriam Kostman. Miriam Kostman is, I think, quite a well-known speaker from Bnei Brak, and she wrote a book called Circle, Arrow, Spiral, Exploring Gender in Judaism. And again, that book is more about gender than male-female roles. She kind of avoids... What's that? Footnote number 5, I brought you a reference to that. And she really wants to talk in that book about gender rather than actual male-female issues in society, which is probably sensible because she stays out of controversial issues by talking more theoretically. But it's well worth a read, that book, and Mrs. Kostman is a very, very sought-after speaker. How this feeds into modern-day transgender realities is a good question, which I don't really know the answer to. Meaning, I don't want to stand here and suggest that every individual who says that he or she feels a gender dysphoria is manifesting some spiritual imbalance of the Dukhra and the Nukva. I really have no idea how one translates into the other. I do know that there is such an issue as this spiritual reality of male and female. We have to think about how that affects different people in different ways, but I'm not able to understand exactly how that works because I lack the Kabbalistic training to be able to really do that. I can tell you that some of the more Kabbalistic commentators do make this point of the spiritual reality, again, separated for a second from transgender questions, and they talk, the Kaf HaChaim I brought you in number 10, I'll leave you to read this more in your own time. The Kaf HaChaim has some fascinating analysis about when we say in the morning, Shalo Yasani Isha, Shalo Yasani Goy, Shalo Nisani Ovid, etc., he says, when we go to sleep at night, our neshama goes up to Shamayim and is judged on different levels for different things, and we may end up the next day with a different neshama than we had the day before. It may have been a male one day and it's a female the next day, and it may have been a free one day and it's an Eved the next day, Jew one day, non-Jew the next day. Again, do I know what this means? No, I don't know what this means. I know that the Kaf HaChaim knows what it means, and it's there for you to read. He even brings it into questions of Michal Bat Shaul, Michal Bat Shaul, who the Gemara says wore tefillin, says the Kaf HaChaim. Of course she did. She had a male neshama. That's why she wore tefillin. And not surprising, they talk about Yehuda having a female neshama, Tamar having a male neshama, Yitzchak having a female neshama. Please look this up. Speak to your own local Orthodox Kabbalist and get some reading of those. But this is a real question within Jewish thought. I just wanted to flag this at the beginning. It's not so straightforward. And of course, you need to have a deep and broad education in such matters. And without that education, it's very difficult to make a clear comment. But I wanted you to be aware of that because it's out there. Let's get on to something much easier, which is it permissible to have a gender reassignment surgery? And there the answer is no, it is not. There is no debate on that whatsoever. Halakhically, it is absolutely clear, with one small maybe question that comes into the sugya in a minute. But there are many reasons why it is not permissible to have a gender reassignment surgery. If you look in number 14, this is talking, we just read this a few weeks ago in the Torah, about various different animals who have blemishes that are not kosher for korbanos. Ma'uch, v'chatut, v'natuk, v'charut, lo tegridu la'ashem. These are all animals with maimed or crushed genitalia of different kinds. They are not valid for korbanos. And then the pasuk says, uba'atzachem lo ta'atu. And you can't do that. You can't create that reality and spay an animal or neuter an animal in any of your countries either, not just for korbanos. And if you remember, I don't know how far back people remember, we had a series of shirim on pets when we talked about neutering and spaying animals, etc. This is a Torah prohibition. This would apply not only to animals, but also to people as well. Look at number 17 for a second. We'll go back to 15 and 16. Actually, look at number 16 first. Minayin lesirus ba'adam shehu asa. How do we know that you're not allowed to? This talks about animals in the pasuk. How do we know this relates to people as well? Talmud lomar ubra'atchem lo ta'asu, bachem lo ta'asu. Don't do this to yourselves either. And therefore, there is a Torah prohibition to neuter, certainly a male. If you look in number 17, says the Rambam, asur lahafsid evrei zera. You are not allowed to destroy the reproductive system, bein ba'adam, bein ba'behema, whether of a human being or the havdal of an animal, chaya va'oif, or a beast or a bird, echa tmeim, echa tahorim, it doesn't matter whether they're kosher or not kosher animals, bein ba'eretz Yisrael, bein ba'chutz la'aretz, whether you're in Eretz Yisrael or chutz la'aretz, and the Rambam goes on to say that even though it says uba'atachem lo ta'asu, we learn in the oral law that this applies across the board. And he finishes off and he says, v'chol ha'misareis, anyone who has this operation performed, etc., loket min ha'torah. There is an issa d'oraisa. And therefore, clearly, taking away the male reproductive anatomy is a Torah prohibition. Sterilizing a female, number 18, over the page, Amasari says in a keva, bein ba'adam, bein b'shar, meaning whether a human or an animal, patur aval asur. That is not asur, that's not prohibited to the same degree, but it is clearly still prohibited, and there is a debate whether it's an issa d'oraisa or an issa d'rabbanon, but it's certainly prohibited. I would just point out and say here, and this is not our topic, obviously if there is a medical need or necessity to do this, which can happen in a number of different cases, then clearly it's permitted. This is not something which is one required to, God forbid, to die for, and therefore there are many cases where there are medical needs to remove this or remove that or change this, and that is 100% fine. Yes.
What about biological warfare of pests? They neutral.
That's very interesting. What they do, they basically sterilize pests in order to prevent them from breeding. It's a good question. I haven't thought about it. This is usually talking about physical castration or physical involvement. If you do things which change hormonal or biological, then that's rather different. We had a series of shiurim, we talked about birth control, and we saw there that actually taking pills for birth control, which prevent the ability or solubility to become pregnant, is halachically much less significant than physically operating on people. So I suspect the answer clearly is that it's fine to do that, and I assume that the lomdus is because you're not involving yourself physically. You don't go through each pest individually and neuter it. You do a biological treatment on that. So I'm sure that would be acceptable in many cases. But here, clearly, physically to involve oneself in a surgery is not permitted. Now, the one caveat I said is that this is not something which is one which is required to die rather than transgress. This is not one of the big three of Avodah Zarah, Shvichas Damim, or Giloy Arayas. And therefore, a very interesting halakhic question is going to come up where there is an individual who is a genuine suicide risk, which could be. And Rabbi Weinreb addresses this in his shir. If an individual is really a genuine suicide risk, and without transgender or gender reassignment surgery, that is an imminent suicide risk, that's a very interesting shaila. Because one would not have to, God forbid, die rather than undergo this, and one could see an argument being made that this will be permitted in order to save a life. However, it's a complicated shaila because one have to look at what the suicide risk will be after the surgery as well, and it's not so straightforward that doing this surgery will indeed take away the problem. But that is a complex shaila for a major posek. Yes?
Would that then mean that there's more flexibility for a female transition?
Yes, and perhaps on that issue, because it may be a suffix of whether Dorais or Drabonon. But again, you need world-class posekim to weigh in on these issues. Apart from that, if one wants to have a gender reassignment surgery, you can't just check into your local clinic and have it done next Thursday. It's not something they'll do. Maybe you can get a nose job done in that way in LA or something like that, but you certainly can't do that in terms of gender reassignment. There will be extensive counseling involved, and one of the things that will be required is for whichever person wants to, whether it's male or female, wants to transition, they will be required to dress as and live as the other gender before they have the surgery in many cases. That itself presents halachic problems of cross-dressing, etc. And I brought you in number 20. The Rambam talks about that as well. This is not This is not controversial in halacha. This is clearly well known. A man cannot dress as a female and live as a female, or a woman as a male. That will also be an issue. Also, number 21, self-inflicted wounds which have no necessity, have no medical imperative, is also prohibited. And again, you'll have to get into a question of what is a medical imperative. We talked about that when we talked about cosmetic surgery, as to under what circumstances there is a psychological imperative, which means this is a medical imperative. And there's no question that psychological factors really are relevant here. There was a tosis we looked at on that. But in principle, it's very clear that there is no halakhic permission to have a gender reassignment surgery, save maybe in the very complicated case of the suicide, and even then that would have to be thought through very carefully. So that's easy. You can't have a gender reassignment. The question, which is much more complicated, which in many ways is much more interesting, I think, halakhically, is let's say somebody does. They didn't ask a shaila, they went ahead and did it, or we'll see that Rabbi Avers, we'll talk about him in a minute, has many tshuvas on. He used to be the dayan in Amsterdam. And whatever is happening around the world, Amsterdam is an early adopter, if you like, of trends. And he was faced with an interesting situation of a man who was a convert who'd already had a transgender reassignment, or it could be a Baal Tshuva or whatever. Does the gender change, yes or no? So let's see if we can get some clarity on that. The Mishnah talks about obviously male and female, but it also talks about something called tumtum and androgynous. Look at number 22. Hashliach va'eved va'isha. There are a number of people who bring bikurim or don't bring bikurim or read the special recital of the mikra bikurim. And I'm not getting into exactly how this works with a shaliach or an eved or a woman. But then it says untumtum and an androgynous. Meivin v'loy kairin she'eni yichonim loma asher natata li asher. Fine. What is a tumtum and what is an androgynous? So a tumtum and androgynous work like this. A tumtum is a baby that is born, and this is a physical reality. This is nothing to do with psychology or transition. There are a certain number of babies, unfortunately, which are born, a certain number in every 10,000, with unclear sexuality. Either a tumtum, where halakhically it's not clear what sex the baby is, because there are no sexually external sexual signs, that's a tumtum, or an androgynous. An androgynous is a baby that, or a person that exhibits both male and female sexuality. If you look in Rambam number 23, tumtum va'androgynous hari haim safek. We don't know what sex a tumtum is. Is it male or female? Androgynous, male or female, we don't know. V'noitnim aleihem chumrei ha'ish v'chumrei ha'ish v'chol makam. And therefore it's a very tricky business. We have to give this individual the chumras, the stringencies of bowing both the male and a female, because we don't know which one it is. Now, a tumtum, it may be possible to find out, because a tumtum, there may just be a short operation that can be done to reveal, and maybe skin over, covering the genitalia, we can reveal what that is. Androgynous is much more complicated, because there are both. And you might have to decide to go one way or the other. In the meantime, it's certainly a sophic, and therefore, this person has the chumras of both a male and a female. In the sense they have to be shown in a gi with a man and with a woman, they can't marry a man or a woman, etc., etc. It's very complicated there. How do they dress? That's a good question. The last chapter of Bikurim deals with this. What is a practical question on a, I don't know about a daily basis, but certainly for many, many years, is that when loyalenu babies are born in this situation, and that happens one in every however many thousand, someone has to make a decision as to what sex this baby is. Is this baby a boy or is this baby a girl? And that has to be done, obviously, in very close consultation with rabbinic advice. Because sometimes the doctors may turn around and say, well, you know, clearly this is 80% this, 20% that. We'll make a decision. It's not so straightforward. There has to be a lot of thought that goes into this. The Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva here in number 24. Again, I'm not getting into it in great detail because this is not really our topic. But tinok shenolag umibichina chitzonit from an outside examination, this baby was born apparently as a female with some external male characteristics. But genetically, because now we can chromosomally check XX or XY, we know that it's a boy. So chromosomally, this child is a boy, but it appears to be a girl. Are you allowed to intervene in terms of operations physically, and clarify whether it is a boy or a girl by turning it into a boy, turning it into a girl. Now, usually, physically, in terms of the medical intervention, it's much easier to become, to make the baby into a female than a male, because there's less construction that needs to be done. But it's not so straightforward, and one, under the Tzitz Eliezer points out there that halakhically, what's most relevant here is the external examination. And the chromosomal reality may not be what decides the sex of the child, and that's obvious, because in order to, for halacha to work, you don't, you're not required to be living in the 21st century with access to modern labs and tests, etc. Halacha has to be able to work if you're a Yemenite in the 2nd century, as well as if you're an American in the 23rd century, and therefore external examination clearly is going to be very dominant in terms of the Tzitz Eliezer. And as far as I'm aware, this is pretty much the approach of most poskim on this question. But again, it really depends on the case. And there are many different scenarios that can present themselves. But in terms of birth gender, that's generally external rather than internal organs or genetic configuration. Now, in terms of transgender surgery itself later in life, because don't forget, androgynous and tumtum are not the question of transgender. They are babies that are already born that way, and they are not separate sexes either. There is a discussion in the Mishnah as to whether androgynous could be a third gender of mixed male and female, and there are actually societies in the world where they recognize, not Jewish societies, other societies, in India, etc., where a third gender is a recognized reality. But that's not clear either. I've seen people very clearly state, oh, in halacha there are multiple genders, male, female, androgynous. That's not true. There's male and there's female. Androgynous and tumtum are probably halachic svekas, they're halachic doubts based on the anatomy, not necessarily genders. Tumtum certainly isn't a gender, a separate gender, and androgynous, there's a debate as to whether that is or it isn't, probably isn't. But transgender is a separate question. It's not a new question. The Ibn Ezra picks this up already in the 12th century. There is a posik about male homosexual relations, and by the way, that's not the topic at all of today's share. That's a completely different discussion. Number 25, Zachar lo tishkav mishkavei isha to'evahi. It says ve'et zachar. What's being added? Ve'et zachar. So the Ibn Ezra comes in and says, what is the extra person being added by the word ve'et zachar? Vayomar Rav Chananel, number 26, he quotes Rabbeinu Chananel, who's North Africa already in the 11th century, very old source. Ki yesh mi sheyichadesh begufo. There are people, he says, who wish to innovate in their physical bodies. Ketsurat basar isha. There are men who want to become women. And that's something that people do. Vze lo yitachem betolada. It's not a natural thing, it's something that they intervene to do. And the question is, if a man were to have that gender reassignment surgery and then have a relationship with another man, so that, he says, is the case the Torah is talking about. So very fascinatingly, and he says clearly that it doesn't work, that individual is still male, and that's what the posuk comes to include, even though they might say, well, I now am a female, I've had a recent surgery, I identify. It apparently doesn't work halakhically to do that. What I find fascinating about that is because this source already is 1,000 years old. And that, by the way, is the consensus of almost all of the poskim, that if an individual has a gender reassignment surgery, even if they go forward with the surgery, it doesn't change the gender. It does not change the gender. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that that individual has to sit on the male side or the female side of the machitza. That's a separate question, and Rabbi Weinreb talks about that. We'll get into that in a minute, maybe. But in principle, it doesn't change the gender, and that is the overwhelming agreement of almost all poskim. And when I asked the Shaila recently to, as I said, Diane Avers, and he clarified that, yes, in terms of the yichud situation, the gender of this woman who used to be a man is still male, even though they had a reassignment surgery. So you do have a man and a woman in a yichud scenario. Whether that makes the yichud prohibited, we'll get to in a minute. But it is important to say that according to almost all poskim, the gender does not change. However, and this is the interesting however, there is a wrinkle in that, which is the Tzitz Eliezer. The Tzitz Eliezer, we'll get to in a second, the tshuva, he had a shaila about an aguna situation, where a woman was married to a man, and the man transitioned to be a woman, and then refused to give her a get. And he's now dealing with whether this woman actually is an aguna, the wife, or whether she's not an aguna. And it has to be seen in that light as well that we're dealing with an aguna case. And we'll see what the Sitta Eliezer says in a minute, but let's first look at a 19th century tshuva of Rav Yosef Pelagi. Rav Yosef Pelagi is not very well known. He is an Italian posek, not like a world heavyweight, but a serious posek. And he has a series of tshuvas here, and I brought one in 28. Bar Sheilacha says, I received a shaila, he says. And we're talking 150 years ago. Im Sarich Get, he's also talking about a Get scenario. Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. Im Yerak Kazot. Do you need a Get if the following happens? V'hu, and this is the scenario. V'ruven, Shenasa Isha, Ruven married a woman. V'isha Echad. Betula ka'achad benot Yisrael, like any other young woman. V'haya ima, Kederech Ish v'isha, and they live together as man and wife, in normal way. V'acha kam shanim, kara la mikra. And after a number of years, something very unexpected happened. Denishtanit menekeva lezachar, bakol mi kol kol. She changed from a woman into a man in every respect. Bakol mi kol kol. Now, this is something that actually could happen hormonally as estrogen levels change. I mean, she won't turn into a man entirely, but there can be a shift from female to male. After menopause, in certain medical scenarios, when testosterone can go up, estrogen can go down. I'm not sure if that's what happened in the 19th century here, but he says he's dealing with a case where a woman turned into a man. Mahu hadin lezot shehayta nekeva ve'eshet ish ve'nasit zachar. What happens in a situation where a woman was a wife, she was an eshet ish, she now is a man? Im tarich ruvin ze legarsha v'get. Does the husband need to give her a get? He was married to a woman, now he appears to be married to a man. Kedat Moshe of Israel. Kivan shehayta ishto eshet ish. She used to be his wife. Or Dilma, or maybe, eino tzarich. Maybe he doesn't need to give this individual a get. Kivan sheeinenu isha. Maybe she's not a woman at all anymore. Ki imesh ish. She's now an ish. And obviously a man cannot give a man a get. There is no such thing. And he concludes, ubi'in she'elat onira. I think the answer is, the loy tzarich get. He doesn't need to give her a get. Because now this woman, who used to be a woman, is now a man, and therefore does not need a get. Dehari nusach haget hu, because clearly the nusach of the get is that the man is giving it to a woman, and this person no longer is a woman, etc., etc., and that's how he concludes. Now, I'm not 100% sure whether this was a Maisa Shehaya that actually happened in his community. It sounds like it was. Whether this was a theoretical question. We'll see in a minute another scenario which is clearly theoretical. But he seems to be saying here that if a woman turns into a man, then she is now a man in that scenario. And she does not require a get. The marriage just dissolves. And what is a theoretical question, if you go over the page to page 7, source number 29 is one of my favorite tshuvas. The Trumas HaDeshen. The Trumas HaDeshen lived, Rav Yisrael Isselin, not Isselis, Isselin, he lived in the 1400s. And he wrote a sefer called Shailas and Tshuvas Trumas HaDeshen. Deshen is Gematria 354, which is the number of days in the lunar year. And he said, I want to write a book with 354 interesting Shailas. And he evidently felt that the Shailas that people were asking him in Europe in the 15th century were not that interesting, or he couldn't fill a book of 354. So he said, you know something, I'm going to make up some really interesting Shailas. And I'm going to write down the answers. And once you're already in the realm of possible Shailas, then the sky is the limit. And look at what he asked here in number 29. This is his 102nd Shaila here. Eshet Eliyahu Hanavi. Mrs. Eliyahu Hanavi, who clearly did not ask a Shaila to the Trumas HaDeshen. Or Eshet Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, or another one of the Amoraim, who went to Shamayim alive. That's the point here. Eliyahu Hanavi went to Shamayim alive, never died. So did Rabbi Shul ben Levi. Im yicholim linase le'ishacher. Are they allowed to get remarried? Here's Mrs. Eliyahu Hanavi, who receives the news that her husband has just ascended to heaven in a fiery chariot. And once she's got over the surprise and shock of that whole scenario, a year or two later, she says, well, how do I move on from here? Can I get married to some other fellow? Do I need a get? Well, her husband's not dead. But on the other hand, she's not going to receive a get because Eliyahu Hanavi is not there to give her one. Does she need to, can she get right without a get? In case the Truma Sedation says you think this is a bit ridiculous, there's a shy lady says, no, I'm telling you there could be practical applications. Im yizke echad kamohem, what happens if someone today goes to Shamayim in a fiery chariot? You never know. Someone could be Zoicha, and then the wife needs to know. So he goes through a whole analysis, which I haven't brought you the whole thing. He says, V'yesh loimah, eishes re'ehu asura. Another man's wife is prohibited to be with another man. The law eshet malach, and not the wife of a malach. An eshet ish is considered adultery, not an eshet malach. Shekulan ruchani v'lo gufani, and Eliyahu HaNavi is no longer an ish. He's a malach. He's changed. And since he's changed from being an ish to a malach, the marriage has dissolved. It's a hafka'at kiddushin, which is a very interesting concept in itself, that retroactively the kiddushin has gone because this marriage could never have been contracted. What's the lomdas here? Rashi explains a very interesting thing, the Minchas Chinuch as well. There are some marriages that are prohibited but halachically work. The kiddushin actually works. And obviously divorce is possible in that scenario. There are some marriages where it does not work. For example, if a Jew marries a non-Jew, that marriage is not halachically valid on any level. Whereas if a Kohen marries a divorcee, that is a prohibited marriage, but the marriage is halachically valid and requires a divorce if it wishes to be ended, needs to be ended. So Rashi explains there, based on Sotzi in the Gemara and Yevamos, that if something happens in the middle of your marriage that, had it happened before the marriage, would have meant the marriage could not take effect, then that will explode the marriage in the middle of the marriage. The marriage is now retroactively invalid. Okay? And therefore, the Minchas Chinuch explains that if somehow the man becomes a malach in the middle of the marriage, since you could never have made a marriage, if let's say somebody brings to the Beis Din, I'm marrying this guy, he's a malach, you know, I suppose many women think that they're about to marry a malach. It doesn't always work out that way. But let's say he genuinely is. He is a malach. The guy is a real angel. There is no marriage. There's no kiddushin, kedav Moshe v'Yisrael. There's no such thing. And therefore, if the husband turns into a malach, then the kiddushin will disappear. So, picking all of that up, the Tzitz Eliezer comes in, chimes in number 30. The Imke. Hachanami, here too, benidoneinu. And here he's talking about the opposite case of Rabbi Yosef Pelagi. It's not the woman that became a man. It's the man that had a gender reassignment that became a woman. By the way, that is the vast majority of scenarios. In most cases of transgender, it's the man that wants to be a woman, not the woman that wants to be a man. And it's an interesting question as to why that is. You can go away and think about that and research it. But that is the, it's just obvious, yeah, maybe. He says here, in Cain v'nidonenu, yesh lama de eshet re'ehu asura. Similarly here, it is a wife, a married woman that is prohibited. The lo eshet isha. And not eshet isha. Va'afal pishek kfar hitchil v'chala ishud, even though there was a marriage originally, shehaita ishid re'ehu, this man and this woman married years before. Mikol makam nifka'in me'aleim ha'kiddushin. The kiddushin, he wants to say, has been uprooted ab initio, in retrospect. V'yoseh denasid shuv eshet isha, because now what's this woman? This woman is now married to a woman. Her husband has transitioned from a man to be a woman. She says, as far as he's concerned, the husband is now a woman, and the marriage is no marriage. The hakashem, the loitavti kiddushin mimalach, just like you can't contract kiddushin with a malach. Kamoikein loitavti nami kiddushin miisha. So too, if a woman comes to marry another woman, they can have a ceremony, they can stand under a chuppah if they want. That is not a halachic marriage. There is no get required. 1 second. Umikevan shekeit ba'ala shelzo nefach v'niyele isha. Since the situation we have now is the husband has turned into a woman, like hasikei kiddushin mimena, and there could be no marriage now between them because it is two women. In kein mimela nafkin kiddushin hakod mimealeh. And therefore, says the Tzitz Eliezer, there is no marriage, there is no kiddushin. She does not need a get. Question.
Yes, it seems that as soon as the man transitions, their marriage is dissolved, which means as soon as he transitions, there's
yichud
issues,
then
a woman can't choose to live with
him.
Maybe not. We'll see that in a minute. Maybe the
yichud
issues don't necessarily follow. But yes.
There are two steps in transition. One is the removal of the male genitalia.
Yes.
The other is the creation of female chimpanzees.
Right. At what point does this happen, you're asking?
And the reason I ask is because right. if a man is involuntarily
yes.
Castrated,
yes.
does that also...
Good. So, no. I don't think there's any question that if a man is involuntarily castrated or castrated for purposes of medical requirements or in an accident, God forbid, that does not turn him into a woman. There's no suggestion of that. But this scenario is where a man went through a full gender reassignment, and again, where exactly in that process the Tzitzi Eliezer will understand the halacha changes, I feel it has to be after just the removal, because then every person who'd been in that situation would become the opposite sex, which is not the case. I want to stress, one second, I want to stress that the Tzitzi Eliezer is in the minority, pretty much, of one in his position here. Meaning, if everyone knows when they discuss this question that almost every posek will say, you can have whatever surgery you wish to have, it will not change the gender. The Tzitzi Eliezer may be saying here that it changes the gender. He seems to be saying that. However, let's not forget, he's saying this in the context of an aguna situation. So clearly he's working in the tshuva to try and release this woman from a marriage that is no longer a marriage on any level. And that feeds into your question, which is, even if he turns round to her and says, I'm now a woman, but this, by the way, was a case that we had recently in Israel, where a man had a transition to a woman, and he said to his wife, I still love you, I love the children, I wish to live with you as together like we did before. That's not going to work for many, many reasons. But you can't necessarily take the tshuva of the Tzitzi Eliezer and apply it more widely. First of all, because almost everybody else disagrees with him. And second, because it's not clear how far he would want that to go. And it's important to say, in no way does he permit a gender reassignment. He's dealing after the fact with someone who had one, and now what is the scenario in an aguna situation? So, it's very important to know that. Yes. Children born. Why would that be an issue? Okay, so there's no stigma to a child that's born out of wedlock. It's not something we'd recommend. But if you turn around retroactively and say the Kiddushin is no Kiddushin, this is a question not just here, but in the whole Aguna situation where, you know, Rabbi Rachman many years ago wanted to push the whole Hafka'at Kiddushin, that you'll unravel the Kiddushin, and people said that, well, then you're retroactively delegitimizing all the children from the marriage. And the answer is yes, and it's not great, but it doesn't not turn them in any way into Mamzerim or anything like that, because, okay, so they're children born out of wedlock. Not something we want, but not something which is going to cause massive problems. Yes?
If we say that one of the things that you're
of the what says, sorry?
DNA.
Right.
Why don't you stress
that? Again, and I'm not saying the DNA has no relevance, but the issue of DNA is that you need modern lab scenarios in order to work that out. How is halacha meant to work? Just like when you add milk to your chicken soup, you don't take it to a lab, have it put through a centrifuge, and then say, well, let's look at like what it is. You have very straightforward tests. Is it a 60th? Can someone taste the milk, etc., etc.? Judaism has to work without the need for scientific intervention. Now, I'm not telling you, therefore, the DNA has no relevance, but it won't have automatic relevance. That's what I'm saying in this situation. Now, if you're going to tell me the DNA is relevant, then there's no chance of it being a sex change, because you can change whatever physically you like. You can't have a chromosomal transplant. That's not how it works. But this is not just a question for transgender. There are women who reach puberty and are surprised to find that nothing is happening, and they're tested, and it turns out they're chromosomally male. That's the scenario that happens. Now, are you going to turn around and say, well, actually, now we realize you're a man. You're a man. You're not a woman. And we don't say that normally. Again, I'm not giving a sack on any particular case, but that's not something we will just do and say we'll look into the DNA. Let me just end with a few issues, because we're not quite finished yet. So on the issue of, let's turn over to page 8, and I've given you a little bit of a summary on the basis of what we've seen. What do we know so far? Gender reassignment surgery is prohibited according to all opinions. Torah and rabbinic prohibitions may be involved. Question being the suicide case that we talked about before. According to almost all, and maybe even all poskim, the surgery does not affect a shift of halachic gender. And it was confirmed recently, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, very major posek, very much involved in modern-day Shilas, has also confirmed he holds that it doesn't change the halachic gender. It may annul the marriage, it may not annul the marriage. The titelliers, again, is in a small minority on that issue. If a person does have a gender reassignment surgery, they will not be allowed to get married to either gender afterwards. That is very clear. A man, let's say, becomes a woman, she will not be able to have a halakhic marriage with a man. No rabbi is going to do a chuppah with another man under the chuppah with that woman, that's for sure. Even as the old gender, let's say that they want to now remarry a woman, that's going to become difficult as well, because if a male is castrated willfully, so that may affect the ability of that person to marry as well, unless there are medical scenarios, etc. On the question of yichud, this is very interesting, because I asked this Shaila, what about my student who wants to dorm with this young woman who used to be a man? So she's still a man. Based on what we've seen now, she is still a man, so it should be a problem. Whether there will be an issue with rabbinic yichud, this gets into the whole question of yichud, because one-on-one there is a doraita yichud problem. But multiple numbers, two and two or something like that, will be rabbinic. Whether you'll factor in the tzitz Eliezer, who might say that the gender has changed, that's an interesting question. But perhaps most importantly, if this man, who has now become a woman, is no longer capable of having a relationship as a man, which clearly they're not if they've had a full surgery, that may take away some of the yichud problem, like it does generally. If you have a question of yichud with an old, sick person, a nurse looking after a person in hospital, etc., there's much less of a yichud question, because there's no real scenario in which this person could engage in kind of relationships. So there, too, there may be a point here that it may be okay, actually, for her to dorm with this girl. I'm not saying it is, but it may be okay, because maybe there's no possibility of a relationship, therefore yichud doesn't kick in. What about Nagia? So again, so Nagia is an interesting question. Nagia may also, in principle, it's prohibited because there's still a man and still a woman. But it may depend on the, Rav Zalman, again, Chemi Goldberg talked about this as well in another scenario, it may depend on the sexual attraction of the person who's transgendered. Because you could have a man who transgenders into a woman who is still attracted to women. And that may play into the scenario. It becomes very complicated. Because it's... Who took what?
Flowers.
Flowers, okay.
Welcome to the neighborhood.
Welcome to the
neighborhood,
that's nice.
Oh,
yes. Okay. You know something? Tune in next week, because next week I'd like to take this into Shomer Nagia. Not with transgender, but generally speaking, and look at some modern-day Shomer Nagia issues. So let's leave that till next week. We're going to talk about that. Let's just finish today with a couple of important final points. I brought you a very important piece. You had a question? No, she wouldn't count for it. A woman who becomes a man counts for a minion? Won't count for a minion. No, that's not going to happen. Having said that, you need to watch the video of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb that I mentioned at the beginning, because there he clearly goes along with most poskim that the gender does not change. However, he says it's not poshut that the now woman should be made to sit on the male side of the mechitza. That's not so poshut. And you can look at his comments on that, because for the issue of where they're going to sit in the shul and the covered habrius of the individual, it's a very difficult balance, of course, because the community is, on the one hand, uncomfortable because this young man who grew up in the community is now sitting in the Ezra's Nashim. On the other hand, that person wants to be in shul, they want to be involved there, they may not count for the minion, but they don't have to sit on the male side necessarily, and again, you need senior poskim to kick in on this. I will leave you to read page 8 for yourself. It's a very important piece from a very important book by Rabbi Chaim Rappaport. Rabbi Chaim Rappaport is a senior poisek in London, a massive Talmud Chacham. He wrote an extremely good book, in my opinion, many years ago now on Judaism and homosexuality, and he's not talking there directly about transgender, but it's an extremely well-written, well-resourced, well-annotated book, written very sensitively, and with a good understanding of the whole, you know, scenario. And I've brought some of the communal issues there as to how we deal with this. And certainly in terms of our relationship to individuals, I brought you two important hashgraphic sources on the top of page 9, which is Rabbi Yanai Omer from Pirkei Avos. Rabbi Yanai says, "Ein biyadeinu lo mishalvat rasha'im va'af lo miyisuri tzadikim." We don't understand, and we never will, why individuals go through different challenges. why people who appear to us to be wicked individuals seem to prosper in this world, and other people who seem to be very innocent and maybe even tzaddikim have terrible challenges in this world, and therefore I think it's critical that we're not judgmental on any level to individuals, meaning the halachic scenarios need to be thought through, what works, what doesn't work in marriage and gender and this, etc. But in terms of why individuals go through certain challenges, there's no question that a transgender reality for someone is, whether we understand it or don't understand it, is an extremely traumatic situation for people. And we don't know why certain people face those challenges, but they do. And the corollary of that in number 34, Hillel says, Al tadin et chavercha ad shetagiyah lebala mekomo. Never judge another person until you've been in their specific situation. And since in many situations this is not going to be possible, we don't really know how a person feels, and this goes across from transgender to other issues, I think there's no question that judgmentalism is out of, and certainly bigotry has got no place anywhere in a legitimate halakhic or hashgafic approach. Having said all of that, on a communal level, it's not straightforward to know what to do, and I'm glad I'm not someone who has to decide these issues. Because as a community, I think we've decided, most communities, that there are people who break halacha, who we accept and welcome into the community on different levels. People who drive on Shabbos, in most communities, are not shunned and made to feel like outcasts. They are brought to shul. There may be halachic implications for this or for that, but they're encouraged to, there's a kirov obligation, if you like, to bring people in. Is that the same in this situation or not? Or is it, okay, people who drive to shul on Shabbos, that doesn't in some way go to the root of the fabric of what we want a Jewish society to look like, whereas people who transition from male to female or vice versa or same-sex marriage or whatever, maybe you could say that that actually is much more fundamental, and you're not going to treat it in exactly the same way as you treat someone who is not Shomer Shabbos. Again, I have no good answer to that, but I can see a difference between the two situations just in terms of, I don't know, simple questions of inviting people to your Shabbos table. I think most people would not have a problem inviting someone who is drives on Shabbos or whatever, even people who have families where grandparents are not showing the Shabbos. There are ways of educating children and dealing with this in a sensitive way. Maybe this issue is a little bit different, and it could be that it has to be thought through in that way. It's good. It's fine. There's only 1 minute left anyway. Just two more points, and let me finish. On the issue of in number 36, I brought you the tshuva from Dayan Avis from Amsterdam, who said he spoke to the Tzitz Eliezer about various different issues where this gentleman in Holland wanted to join the community, to reconnect with the Orthodox community. Actually, I think I was wrong before. I don't think he was a ger. I think he was a Baal tshuva in that case. And he gives the analysis that we've been through, the person is halakhically still the old gender, but he points out that absolutely on an individual level we have an obligation to reach out to such individuals with love and with kirov in whatever way we can to not reject people because of the situation they've been in. That he got directly from the Tzitz Eliezer. Having said all of that, on a societal level, I think it's very important for us to, as a society, take something of a stand against the cultural shift, the whole blurring and intersex kind of shift. I'm not here talking about individuals who have personal issues, but the whole society. We have to be a little bit slower, I think, to be as non-judgmental on these issues, because I think there are real problems, clearly, and I'm sure most people in this room would agree, that we can't just sit by and say, oh yeah, everything goes. Everything doesn't go, and there are certain things in society that clearly are moving in a direction that we're fundamentally not happy with, based on our model of what the family is, and what a healthy relationship between a mother and a father and child, etc. is. Again, how you apply that on a day-to-day level is a good question, but that needs to be thought through. And I think if you separate out those questions into different scenarios, how you treat the individual, how you treat the general cultural issue, I think one can get to a slightly more nuanced approach on this. So this is a big topic. I have done it quickly because I don't really want to do a cheerium on transgender, but hopefully that does give us an introduction. Next week we go to the relatively safer ground of what normally would I think was a very difficult issue, but compared to this isn't, which is Schermerhorn gear, which we've never talked about in this scenario, but there are some very important modern day applications to that, halachic and hashkafic. Let's talk about that then, but between now and then I wish you a very good week.